Thank you for the opportunity to be here. As Jenny said, my mom was born just on the banks of the Lesser Slave Lake, which is just down the road from Drift Pile, Swan River Band. She was born there in 1937 in a tent and lived in a tent for 6 years. I always wanted to say something auspicious like that, but the best I can do is that my mom was born in a tent. So we want to talk about, they asked me to talk about race and reconciliation, so that's what I want to do. But I just want to talk with you and share some things and then sort of tell my own journey working through these things. So then I do have a text, Matthew 7. 1-5. It's what I thought about right away. And it says, "Judge not, that you be not judged. For with the judgment you pronounce, you will be judged. And with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. Why do you see the speck that is in your brother or sister's eye, but do not notice the log that is in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother or sister, 'Let me take the speck out of your eye,' when there's a log in your own eye? You hypocrite. First take the log out of your own eye, then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye." I guess what I was thinking about was that so often when we think about racism, we often think that's something that is in other people. I noticed that when I moved to Vancouver in the 2016, that many people in Vancouver actually believed that systemic racism that existed in Canada didn't apply to them, or that they had opted out, which showed they don't really understand how racism works in our society. So then I was thinking about this passage. It's also a meaningful passage because the Lord kept bringing me back to this passage for a long time, for maybe a year or two. Just my mind would keep coming to this passage. So I thought about it because I was trying to think through, what's the log in my own eye that I can't see? Because I was in ministry and I was aware, they train you to be aware of your weaknesses, and all the time when you have to go to those denominational training things, at some point they'll ask you about your weaknesses and you'll be, you verbalize them. But I didn't feel it in my heart. I didn't feel it in my heart, God often brought me to this passage. I also was thinking about the penitential rite of the Anglican Church, and it reads, "Most merciful God, we confess that we've sinned against you in thought, word, and deed, by what we have done and by what we have left undone." And I wanted us to think about that second part, what we have left undone. With the finding of the unmarked graves, Canada was brought face to face with the reality of its own attitude towards Indigenous people. Even though the Truth and Reconciliation Commission report made it plain that from 3,000 to 6,000 children, which was a conservative estimate, said Justice Murray Sinclair, 3,000 to 6,000 children had died while attending residential schools in Canada. By the surprise and emotion that flowed out of society with the finding of the unmarked graves, it was evident that most people, most Canadians, did not believe that this had really happened until there was evidence that it happened. And even though this was announced years earlier, somehow Canadians had developed mind and emotion-numbing techniques to keep them from thinking about the level of injustice that they had been willing to swallow with regard to Indigenous people in Canada. Sorry, this thing keeps falling off. My head's big. My wife tells me that all the time. She kind of keeps me straightened out, so I'll do my best. I feel like if I move, it's going to fall off. So, and it was not residential schools alone that had tragic impact upon Indigenous people. I remember being in Churchill, Manitoba, which is right on the banks of the Hudson Bay. The ice goes out there in July. It's where people go to watch the polar bears. And we saw polar bears. But one of the local people there, the Métis fellow, he took me out to see a dog musher who had a couple hundred dogs and that they used on dog teams. And while we were out there, we started driving around, and there was these little foundations of where little houses used to be. And they were all over there. And I asked him, what are those? He said, that's the Dene village. I said, well, what's the book? Well, in the 1950s, Canada decided to move the Séyéyssé Dene from Tadoule Lake, which is where they lived traditionally. They forced settled them to Churchill, Manitoba. And there, a third of their people died because there was a loss of culture and identity. And they eventually made the government help them move back because they said, if we stay, we're gonna perish. We're all gonna die. It was just one example of forced settlement or relocation of people by the government, a government that thought they knew best for Indigenous people. Canadians knew about these programs, but somehow they were lulled to sleep by the mind-numbing message of modern society that can never admit that it has done anything wrong. There was also the 60s scoop, where Indigenous children were taken and put into non-Indigenous homes. Now, the parents who adopted these children or took them in as foster parents did not know that the children's parents were not dead, that they were not really orphans. And so these well-meaning Canadians took them in. Well, not only Canadians, they also, for a price, adopted children into the United States. CBC Radio ran a show on this in the 1970s, highlighting that this was just weird. And on it, they had an Indigenous couple who had trying to adopt these Indigenous children, and the government wouldn't let them. They sent them to the United States to be adopted there, and then 2 years later, those people in the United States sent them back. They didn't want these kids anymore. But it highlighted this thing that was going on in the 60s. My auntie gave up a daughter, and they adopted her out. The foster care adopted her out. She was part of the 60s scoop. And there was can't remember if she was Inuit or Dene. What they did is they matched these two little girls together, even though they weren't related, and they told this family that these were twins, but they weren't twins. And when I met my cousin a few years back, she connected with us, and she said eventually the other girl, she just got tired of it and left, found her way back home when she was about 12 years old, and connected. People knew about these but didn't do anything. I'm glad, though, in Canada that there's this emotional outpouring that these things have happened and that they shouldn't continue to happen. My whole thinking about the way that it works in Canada about systemic racism towards Indigenous people really shifted. I watched in the 1990s, I watched a documentary called Manufacturing Consent, Mind Control in a Democratic Society, Noam Chomsky in the media. And it shifted. And what he did was he just measured column inches of newspaper articles. And he was thinking about, one of the focuses he did was on the Vietnam War. Now, even though America killed almost as many civilians as Pol Pot did with its carpet bombing, that received very little. They didn't write about it in American papers, but Pol Pot, he killed thousands of civilians. They ran huge amounts. And Noam Chomsky just said, we tend to, our media, how we think about things, we tend to justify the status quo That's how we are in society. And we just can't believe that we would do these other things. Even though in another book, Noam Chomsky says, and I'm just using as an example, I'm not saying they're any different than we are, but the America runs more terrorist or counterinsurgency in the world than any other nation in the world. Yet we can't conceive that we would do that, you see. Okay, that's enough of my political stuff. But I just said, in Canada, see, part of the systemic racism is we have tended to view ourselves as part of a Christian empire. Most churches in the West and in Vancouver have a Christendom hangover. We still think we're part of a Christian empire, a Christendom, and that the only thing we need to do is to sort of get people to come to our whatever it is, because basically we're good people. And so I thought about that, and I thought about it, our own denomination. When I was, at one point, I was the director of the Indigenous Studies, or director of the First Nations Alliance Churches of Canada, and I was for the Christian Missionary Alliance. And I remember when I watched this film, I realized, but we do that. We do that in the Alliance, too. We spin things when it comes to Indigenous work. We were slowly starving it to death. We continually cut money from the First Nations Alliance Church of Canada budget. When I started, it was $100,000. I think now it's, I don't know, $17,000 or something a year. But all the time we wring our hands and say, but we care so much, we care so much. But in the next meeting, money and support is cut. So then I just thought, we do this. But why can we do this so easily? I think, as I thought about it, I thought, you know, Karl Barth, the theologian Karl Barth, who was around the time of Germany, was, because he and Dietrich Bonhoeffer spoke out against what Germany was doing to the Jewish people, Barth's standing at the university was revoked. But he said, you know, the sort of the pinnacle of sin is self-righteousness. We believe that we could judge our own righteousness and determine if someone else was unrighteous. That's the pinnacle of sin. And that's really at the heart of racism. I heard Rick Tobias, who was the CEO of Yonge Street Mission for a long time in Toronto. Now, it's his quote. I didn't check it out. I hope he's right. He said that Martin Luther King Jr.'s theologian said that the primary theological problem, or the whole thing about racism, is that we look down on another group of people as being less than us. And that's the heart of racism. Residential schools happen in Canada because Canada looked down on Indigenous people as children. It wasn't long after, because when Canada was becoming a nation, they regarded Indigenous people as wards of the state. They weren't regarded as citizens. In the late 1800s, they actually had a Gradual Civilization Act. And in it, an Indigenous person could renounce their indigeneity and become an enfranchised citizen in Canada with voting rights, because you couldn't vote in Canada unless you were a citizen, and Indigenous people weren't considered citizens in Canada. No, they didn't. Indigenous people didn't receive the vote in Canada until 1960. And so then that's why they developed residential schools. John A. MacDonald said that the problem with Indigenous people is a moral problem. And so then residential schools were to teach inner virtues and morality, which is what you have to do in an individualized society like the Western world. You have to teach inner, it's got to be individualized. So then they developed residential schools to re-socialize Indigenous children, to break every relationship that they had, relationship with their family, with their land, and with their spirituality, so that they would become Euro-Canadian in their thinking and in their dress and in their language. Residential school was a program that idolized death because it sought to use death as a way to cure society. William Stringfellow, who was a Harvard-trained lawyer who practiced law in Harlem, wrote a book called... No, I can't remember the name of the book, sorry. It'll come to me as I go along. But he said, the spirit of the Antichrist can be discerned in those societies that seek to use death as a way of ordering or controlling society. That's the spirit of the Antichrist, one that idolizes death as a way to manage society. Ward Churchill wrote a book using a phrase that was used in Canada and the United States in the late 1800s to kill the savage and save the child. That was the justification for the residential school. So residential schools, forced relocation, all are examples of policy that focused on killing something for what it perceived to be the greater good. This idolizing death, how could it be? Canada are good people. Canadians are good people. People always say, someone said to me recently, said, you're friends with everybody, rednecks, you know, hipsters. I says, well, I don't know. I just thought we were all kind of the same, maybe. And on one level, you know, I got lots of friends that are kind of racist, but I don't know, at least they're honest about it. And so how could this be? Canada, they're good people. Canadians are good people. You wouldn't, you know, you go up to most Canadians and say, are you a racist? They're not going to say, yeah, I was. Yeah, I am. They're going to say, no, I know Ray Aldridge. He's a friend of mine. I'd say, yeah. But they all look with, sometimes you find yourself looking with nostalgia on the past as a time that the church was really strong in Canada. The way that we do that with our religion is that religion becomes a way, the role of religion comes to control the faithful by promising them what's going on will lead to something good and by telling them their intentions are good. That's the role of religion plays. In this sense, paternalism marked the alliance Canada developed with Indigenous people. They were paternalistic. And paternalism and racism are on the same continuum, just one's a little meaner than the other one. But they both look down on people as being a problem to be solved. The problem in Canada is that Christianity, like the United States, has become a folk religion. Folk religion is used to enforce the status quo. It's used to call people to be better behaved. Don't rebel against church government. Religion wanted to be approved by the new scientific worldview that was developing in the Enlightenment period, and so it agreed to be relegated to the internal world of values, which have no public bearing, for the only thing that's public is scientific facts. But Christianity just sort of abdicated its ability to speak into the public realm because faith became just something that's interior. Christianity, the prosperity gospel, is an example of capitalist culture becoming synonymous with Christian faith. Lots of Indigenous people turn away when they realize the prosperity gospel doesn't work for them. You know, the prosperity gospel is just that if you receive Jesus, everything will be okay. You'll have lots of friends, all your diseases will go away, and you'll have lots of money. But lots of Indigenous people were receiving Jesus. In fact, when I was in Regina, I couldn't find anybody who hadn't received Jesus multiple times, but it wasn't working. They weren't rich. people still treated them poorly because of the color of their skin, and they still had problems with diabetes and different things. It wasn't working. Christianity promised these things, but it didn't work. Christianity is like folk religion, but it's called people to be more pious and better behaved and no longer hear the call to conversion. One of the great things about, no, that's the wrong word. One of the impactful things about the finding of the unmarked graves is that it serves as a prophetic call. And we hear the call to be transformed, to be transformed. We're all human beings. The elders, Indigenous elders, continue to call Canada to reconciliation, to turn from death to life. It's Indigenous people, it's the survivors of the residential schools who ask for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. It's the survivors of Indigenous, of the residential schools who calls Canada for reconciliation. Elijah Harper called the Sacred Assembly in 1995 after the killing of Dudley George in Ipperwash, after Premier Mike Harris said, "Get those fucking Indians out of there." And a little while later, an OPP officer shot and killed Dudley George. And in response to that, Elijah Harper, who is from Red Lake, Ontario, he's the man who held up the eagle feather and killed the Meech Lake Accord, if you know history in Canada. He called for a sacred assembly to seek a spiritual solution to the enmity that existed in Canada between the races of people who called Canada home. It was the Indigenous people who called for it. It was the Indigenous people who called for the Truth and Reconciliation, the survivors of the residential school. And they paid for it out of their settlement. It was not the church, and it was not the Canadian government. And why is that? I always wonder, why is that? Because in Cree society abhors violence against another human being. When we made treaty, the treaty affirms four things: peaceful existence, access to land, the bounty of Mother Earth, to be who we were created to be. And this was extended to the newcomers too, because the Cree and the Anishinaabe, they wanted to call these people human beings. They said the Anishinaabe, which is what people call Ojibwe people, the Anishinaabe, they wanted to call the newcomers Anishinaabe. That's their word for human beings, like people. But the Europeans didn't want to be called that. They wanted to be something else. Indigenous treaty. BC is a good example. They didn't want to make treaty with Indigenous people. That's why there aren't treaties. That's why when the land acknowledgement, we acknowledge that we're on unceded territory, because British Columbia refused to make treaty. Well, eventually they had to. In fact, as early as Prime Minister Wilfrid Laurier told them, oh, I can't make this work, but I'm just going to hold it, okay? Wilfrid Laurier told the British Columbian government, there is no way you're going to get around this. There is no way you're going to have to make treaty. Do you want to switch? Sure. Sorry. The head's too big. There we go. That's why in 1998, the Nisga'a land signed a treaty. It'd been 100 years. They'd asked for a treaty 100 years before. They actually came all the way down from around just north of Terrace. They came all the way down the coast to meet with the provincial government in late 1800s, and the premier of BC wouldn't even come out to meet with them and refused to let him into the provincial legislature. 100 years later, they signed a treaty, receiving almost exactly what they asked for 100 years before. My own story, the real bad thing about racism towards people is that you actually begin to believe the lies that people tell about you. And that happened in my life. When I was growing up, when we played Cowboys and Indians, no one wanted to be the Indians in my family, because Cowboys were good and Indians were bad. And I believed that lie. I believed the lie that you're not competent, because society said we were all lazy, and I believed them. Even though I got my first job when I was 8 years old, pulling weeds out of a strawberry field for 25 cents an hour for a neighbor. And we'd work 5 hours Saturdays. We got $1.25. But my boss was an entrepreneur, and then he'd sell us a bag of chips and a bottle of pop that costs about $1.25. That's business, folks. You don't belong. I remember going to school, and every day when we stood at the front of the, we had to show our hands, and if your hands were clean, you got to sit down, but if they were dirty, you had to stay standing up, and every day I was the only kid that was standing there, dirty hands. And I felt, I don't belong here. Because my mom, we experienced generational trauma, like Jen talked about. Families experienced generational trauma. This has been like my friend Richard Twist said, it's been 500 years of bad haircuts. And generational trauma. So my mom and I used to fight. I left home when I was 16. I had a big fight with my mom. I said, why don't you just go to hell? And she said, I may go to hell, but you'll be there waiting for me. But I remember walking out and I said, I have become so bad that my mom can't even love me. I believe that fourth lie, you are unlovable. I'm the third generation of people who all tried to pretend we're something else. My grandfather actually used to tell people he was Chinese. He even learned some Mandarin. He was pretty good at languages. He used to work as a translator for the RCMP at different times. My mom used to tell everybody we were mostly French and English. Remember, I'd come home and say, Mom, they called me an Indian at school. The way they say it, I feel so dirty. And she'd say, well, you're part, but you're mostly French and Scottish. I remember when we were at my grandmother's funeral, we took my mom. We were grown by then. Two of my brothers and I took my mom to her mom's funeral, my grandmother's funeral. My younger brother leaned over at one point and he says, I wonder when all the French and Scottish relatives are getting here. But we believe that fifth lie. You shouldn't exist. And in Canada, for years, the official policy was assimilation, and they would pass laws to discriminate against Indigenous people. Political parties would have it in their program, their policy, that Indigenous people were how to solve the Indigenous problem. When you look at Indigenous people as a problem to be solved, you're paternalistic at best. And racist at worst. I remember one time there was a political party asked us why everybody thought they were racist and anti-Indigenous. And we met with them in Ottawa and we said, well, probably because you're racist and anti-Indigenous. That's probably why people say that, because you look at Indigenous people as a problem to be solved. That's why I liked how you put it, Jenny. Just come and learn. Come and learn. We're learners, co-learners. The problem in Canada is that people believe those lies about Indigenous people. Until Dances with Wolves, overwhelmingly, the only reports about Indigenous people supported the status quo opinion that Indigenous people were a problem to be solved. A judge in Regina tells the court on a trial for Pamela George, there's a trial of two white college athletes who are on trial for killing, murdering Pamela George, and the judge to the jury said, well, you need to remember what kind of woman she was. She was a prostitute. She was Indigenous. It was condemned, soundly condemned. But Canadians believe that. Well, I better get done here. I think I'm gone over time. All right. the way that we defeat what we do in our societies, in Western societies, and most societies do that, is we create the version of the other by a society, and then we vilify the other. We vilify the other. This has been happening since like 500. Catholics vilify Protestants. Protestants vilify, demonize Catholics. And none of them are Christian enough. We continued that into the Reformation. The problem, the reason we have so many denominations, we got rid of one pope, and now we have like a million popes. Because everybody has their own thing. They judge themselves righteous. Everybody else is unrighteous. And we look down on one another. It wasn't that indigenous people didn't receive the gospel. Most indigenous people did. But they weren't Christian enough. They weren't Christian enough. So they put them into residential schools. The society creates the category of the unrighteous so they can be blamed for the woes of society. That's why in Western society we blame poor people for being We blame people who have problems that it's their fault somehow. They did something wrong. We're like Job's friends. Job's friends are actually wise for 7 days when they don't say anything. And then as soon as they open their mouth, everything goes to hell in a handbasket after that. To defeat racism, it's defeated by intimacy. On the level of human suffering, we are equal. You want to defeat racism, you need to learn how to speak from the heart. On the level of emotions, you need to speak from the heart. When we were picking programs, my wife and I, to use in Indigenous ministry, we would ask, does this program speak primarily to the head, or does it speak to the heart? If it spoke primarily to the head, it was probably developed by a man. I couldn't resist that one. Because most middle-aged men are emotionally constipated. They get freaked out if you play a drum in church, because they feel something. They get all nervous. So then we developed this program called Unanimon, and the Unanimon was, let's go away for a while and talk about the feelings that we have in our heart. Racism is defeated by repentance. Stop idolizing death and turn to life. We need to take responsibility in Canada for what happened. Everybody, Indigenous, non-Indigenous. Stop trying to prove your own innocence. Take responsibility and begin to work to heal relationships that Jenny talked about. I hope your name's Jenny. I hope I didn't get it wrong. I got called Roy for 4 years by a college professor. We need to embrace our God-given identity. Indigenous people made treaty with newcomers. If you're a Canadian citizen, you're part of the treaty. Canada exists because of the treaty relationship with Indigenous people. And that is your creation story. Canada's right to exist, and it does have a right to exist, is in its relationship with Indigenous people through the treaty. Through the treaty. We need to embrace our God-given story and identity. So like I said, I'm believed all these lies about myself. You need to find a place where you can figure out who you are. Small group, that's what we developed in Unanimon. So a friend of mine, we drove like all over. We were visiting the First Nations Alliance Church of Canada. So he drove from Winnipeg, picked me up in Regina. We went to Prince Albert, Edmonton, Fort McMurray. We drove like 3,000-4,000 kilometers. And we were talking all the time. All the time we were talking about being Indigenous men and what was going on inside of our soul. And I used to always say, what do I need to do? What do I need to do? One time he said to me, why do you always ask, what do you need to do? And you never ask, Who do I need to be? And I remembered a time when I was about 8 years old, and I remembered I was really hurt by something somebody said to me, and I just felt like, I saw this in my head, and I felt like this victim. And I said, I just feel like this victim. I said, I don't know what to do. And he says, there's something worse than your pain. I said, what is it? He said, it's your sin. And I said, yeah, what a jerk. I mean, what are you feeling? I'm feeling all like abused, and you're telling me it's my sin. I said, but what's my sin? He says, you believe you're unlovable. And I thought, that's it. I believe I'm too bad. Most Indigenous youth think they're too bad for Jesus to love them. Most men who don't receive Jesus believe they're too bad. They think it's noble to suffer for their sin, for that's what they deserve. But that's sin too. Because sin is something that keeps us from receiving the love of God, the love of Christ. So in Ananamoon, we just sit and talk with people, and we just tell them again and again, did you know that Jesus not only loves you, he likes you. He likes you. He really does. If you want to form an alliance with Indigenous people to work together, make sure it's not paternalism. Just make sure it's not paternalism. I remember my own journey, and I'll end with this story. My own journey. I was taking a course called The Hole in the Gospel. It was about community development. And one day, the professor, David Koop, who used to work for World Vision, he stands up and he says, tell me all the words that you think of when you think of the poor. And so there was a few of us in class, and we gave them all these words. Sick. Poverty. We had a list of like 20 words, you know, impoverished, hungry. We just had all these words for poor people. And then he said, and then we went through them all. We went through them all. And he said, is this word positive or negative? Impoverished. Is that positive or negative? Negative. You know, because we all had good intention. We all felt compassion for the poor. And so we'd go to the next, you know, sick or infirm because of their poverty. They have a lot of sickness, a lot of disease. So he'd just go, is disease a positive or negative word? Negative. All of our words except for two, because some people were quite spiritual and thought of those verses, blessed are the poor. So but it wasn't me. All of them were positive. So then he said to us, do you think you have a positive attitude about poor people or a negative attitude? And by the answers, we have a negative attitude. I used to do this with people about Indigenous people. Same thing happened. And I'd say, do you think you have a positive attitude about Indigenous people or a negative attitude? I did the same thing with high schoolers, grade 11 school kids, high schoolers in Regina. I asked them about people with disabilities. Same thing. We look at people who aren't like us as less than us. We have a negative attitude. So I said, I got a negative attitude about poor people. And the light was shone on me, you see? What is the speck you see in your brother's eye and you can't see the log in your own eye? And then he said, do you think on a Saturday night when you're watching a movie you would hang out with someone you have a positive attitude about or a negative attitude about? Well, a positive. So he said, you're never going to watch a movie with poor people. And again, I was just cut right to the heart. I thought, man. And then he said, do you think you have anything to offer poor people? And I said, oh, yeah. I had my first job when I was 8. By the time I was 12, I was buying a lot of my clothes. I worked hard. I worked 6 days a week, 11 hours a day when I was 12 years old for a farmer. I could show people how to work. And then he says, do you think a poor person has anything to offer you? And I realized, no, I don't. I don't. And he said, if you don't think poor people have anything to offer you, you're paternalistic at best and racist at worst. And I realize I'm racist towards poor people. I think that they don't have anything to offer me, and I have everything to offer them. I look at poor people as less than human. In Canada, a friend of mine moved here from the Philippines. He was, we were both ministers in the Christian Missionary Alliance. And I made this motion once at a district conference. I said, we should affirm that God wants Euro-Canadians to be reconciled with First Nations people corporately and individually. We should just affirm that as a conference. They argued about that because they thought I was trying to do something sneaky that was going to amount to some money somehow, somewhere. But my friend, Julius, he got up and he says, you know, I was only in Canada for 2 weeks and I figured out who the most despised people group in this country is. We look down on people as having nothing to offer, so then even our good intentions, they're worshiping death. And they look at another group of people as having nothing to offer them. That's paternalism. Best and racism at worst. Unless you sit in a place and you realize that we need each other and that you have someone shine that light on you and you won't, and you don't feel it, you won't change. You won't change. You'll just go away and you'll forget. You'll feel bad. And it'll be like the Matrix. Just eat a cookie. You'll feel okay. You won't catch the illusion. That's okay. So in the end, for me, if you want to defeat racism, it's about intimacy. It's connecting with people on a heart level. It's about educating yourself. So glad you're doing this, because unless you educate yourself, you're not going to be able to build reasons why you're changing what you do. And you need to realize that we're all impoverished in different ways. And we all have strengths in different ways. And we need to use what we have for the good of the community. Thank you so much.